shot his wife as she was cleaning up the kitchen after lunch. When his 10-year-old son came to investigate the commotion, the father shot him too. His 6-year-old daughter had the good sense to hide in the bathroom, but reports suggest he lured her out by telling her it was just a game. The girl was found shot once in the chest from point-blank range. The mother, who was shot in the stomach, was pregnant at the time. Police arriving on scene after neighbors called 911 found the father in his car listening to the radio.
Welcome back to another episode of the Main Quest podcast. This is, of course, the number one retro gaming podcast that can hide in your bathwater without a snorkel. As always, I am your host, Keith. And the Ghoulcade rolls on with an episode on the Japanese exclusive Clock Tower. This is only the second time I've covered a game that wasn't released here or anywhere else. The other one being Sweet Home, which I covered like 2 years ago at this point. And coincidentally, I think that was also another Ghoulcade episode, if I remember correctly. Fitting, right? But you know what scares me the most? It's not Halloween. It's not getting marijuana in my candy apples. That's not a trick. That is a treat. But what scares me the most is the fact that people would find this show worthy of supporting financially. And if you would like to support the show, you can head on over to patreon.com/themainquest or check out the links in the show notes. And when you head over there, you will see all of the perks included in the Patreon, along with getting a shout out here at the top of the show. And so who brings this episode to you guys? Well, we've got David Palafox, Kayla Jackson, Eric Guess, Ashton, Chris Copleen, Zero Sam, and Van Fernal. Thank you guys so much for supporting the show. Your contributions and everything that goes into this really means a lot. I really, really appreciate it. And so as things tend to go around this podcast, my mind goes to these places. How do I work on the show? How do I make it better? And so this opening monologue is not being recorded after the initial call and discussion of the game in question. So I have no idea how this episode went. So I'm actually sitting here waiting for our guest and also, coincidentally, patron, Van Fernal, to join the call here. So I guess now is more than a better time than just to say, hey, I hope you enjoy this episode. I'm sure whatever we have to talk about is going to be incredibly interesting, and I hope you guys actually learn a lot, because Clock Tower is kind of an important game. So with that, I guess, I'll be waiting, but I'm going to hit the music here, and on the other side, we'll be talking to my mustachioed friend, Van Fernal. Talk to you guys later. Tonight, I welcome to the show a man that can beat anything, no matter how hard it is. Well, I should rephrase that. This is a man that you could give him something hard and he can beat it no matter what.
You really fixed it with that one. Nope. Yeah, no, that definitely came out better than the first one.
He's really good at video games. That's the point I'm trying to get across. You could beat really difficult video games. How about this? It is the number one retro gaming podcast meets the most finely groomed mustache on the internet. And that is, of course, retro streamer extraordinaire, Van Fernal. Welcome to the show, dude.
Wow, that was... That was quite the intro, I must say. I'm glad that I can beat everything in the world that is hard. And yeah, that's something that will come in handy at many different facets in life.
Does it come in handy?
I see what you did there.
I apologize. I apologize. I shouldn't be so... I'm trying to think of another sexual joke. Anyway, welcome to the show.
Sexual joke here.
Yeah, right. This is what the main quest is all about. This is the experience. But yeah, it's good to have you. I don't often have like streamers on. Not that like I avoid streamers or anything like that. It seems like the medias are like two separate things. Like, does that make sense?
Yeah, the thing is, like, ironically, I stream games, but I don't watch that many streams. I know that sounds horrible and maybe a little ironic, but if I have time to say to sit and watch someone stream, that means usually I have time to play something myself. So that means I'm on my spare time, sure. You know. So I tend to actually listen more to podcasts, which I listen while I work on the background, and that's how I ran into you guys, Super Garbage Day, New Game Plus. Basically, all those retro podcasts just kind of started popping on my feed. And yeah, I've become a big fan, especially of you and Super Garbage Day. Not kissing up, but you guys are pretty much... I really like your takes because they seem a little more personal, from my opinion. A lot of these podcasts are a little more formulaic, you know. They just kind of run through the motions. You guys, your personalities are very inserted in the product.
Oh, I appreciate it, man. Yeah, I was thinking earlier today about how there's kind of seems to be like an echo chamber among like some podcasts. And I think that, you know, I just did a mailbag episode. Well, when this comes out, I did that last month. And I talked about how I don't listen to a lot of gaming podcasts these days. And I think that's one of the reasons that I don't do that so much, is because they all kind of talk about the same thing. And, you know, yeah, again, shout out to Super Garbage Day. And there's other podcasts, you know, Retro Hangover, Unlockables. They're all doing their own thing. And they talk about games that people typically don't talk about. They're not just going through like, oh, here's Super Mario World and here is GoldenEye 007. And they're not going through the retro games you would expect somebody to go through. Instead, you get Hank Parker's Pro Bass Fisher and, you know, entire series on Kingdom Hearts and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, I also, obviously, you know, you got the bangers and the classics, but I also really enjoy when people go after the more obscure games. Like, I heard one of your episode about that game with Poltergeist.
Jesus,
that whole
yes.
thing sounded yeah. just horrible. And the funny thing is, I was intrigued the whole time. I'm like, this sounds like doesn't sound like a good time, but you talking about it sounds like actually hilarious. So I like when people go after those kinds of games, because if it's all, you know, the Marios, the Zeldas, all that kind of stuff, it's kind of overdone, you know. So I also like when people are forced to play a game that they don't like, because that really gets them out of their comfort zone. And I think that's when the best content really comes out.
Yeah, and you wholeheartedly get that person's opinion on it, because not so many people are talking about those games. Because, like, yeah, when I have to do Super Mario World, it's like, what am I going to talk about? Like, the entire community has talked about this game to death. What more could I say that hasn't been said already? But I mean, you yourself are like, again, you stream and you have been streaming games that like people don't really talk about or play. Like, I've never fucking heard of Prison City.
Yeah, so the thing is, like,
I know it's like a newer game, right?
Yes. So that game actually came out last week. My niche, I play retro games, but I also keep my ear on the ground for games that are modern but retro style.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever one of those comes out, I always like to, first of all, support the devs, because I'm a big supporter of, you know, the retro space. And also, I want to give it a try to see how it stacks up to the old games. Some of them are more paying tribute to old games to a fault. Some trying to give it a more modern spin, but I always like to give those games a try. Also, it's a breath of fresh air from playing old games all the time. I love retro games, but whenever I play, I have a chance to play something brand new, you know, it's always exciting.
Yeah, like, yeah, I think you've tried out Crusader of Senti. There's another one you were trying your hand at a while ago. One of those ninja games.
I did Revenge of Shinobi recently, but that's everybody knows that game.
Not
but,
that.
Ninja Shadow of Darkness for the PS1.
All right.
Yeah. So it's actually, I'm very open to suggestions. A lot of people are like, hey, you should try this game. I'm like, you know what? Yeah, sure. I never heard of the Crusader of Senti game. And a friend of mine goes like, hey, this is like Zelda for Genesis. I'm like, okay, let's try it. And actually, I was pleasantly surprised, but I like to just try something different every time. And I'll be 100% honest. Sometimes it's the day before the stream and I have no idea when I'm streaming. So I just kind of take a shot in the dark and, okay, this looks interesting and just go for it. I'm not super big on keeping a schedule because that puts an extra burden on me to play something specifically. So sometimes I just feel like I want to play a platformer, which is kind of brainless. You just play, beat the final boss and call it a day. And that's what the genre I'm going for.
So let's go back in time. Let's rewind before you started streaming and perhaps before you grew that mustache.
What? This took me 40 years to grow a mustache. I was a very late bloomer, so have some respect.
This is probably like the third or fourth time I brought up the mustache, and maybe only the second time I brought it up with you on air. But for viewers that don't know or haven't like seen your streams yet, you just have the most gorgeous mustache I have ever fucking seen in my life.
Yeah, I decided to tap into my old Spaniard roots, you know. The thing is, like, the reason I have, like, the handlebar and the goatee is because I can't grow the whole thing. It just doesn't connect. I have to kind of style it.
See, I can't style mine because no matter what, I'll just look like white trash. It doesn't matter what I do. So... But yeah, like, let's go back in time, like, to when you were a kid, and when did you, well, perhaps you weren't even a child, I guess I'm just assuming, but when did you even start playing video games? When did you get into it?
So, I have a confession to make. I was born as a full-grown adult. I did not have a childhood. So basically, my father was the original gamer in my family. And he had an Atari 2600. That is my oldest video game memory, that god-awful port of Pac-Man for the Atari. It was, like, horrible. And that is pretty much my oldest memory. It is kind of fuzzy, but I do distinctly remember the day we got the NES at my house. My brother and I, we call it the Super Atari because that's how our minds worked. You know, it was the new and improved. And my dad got it for us with, it came with Super Mario packed in, and we also had Excitebike and Ghosts and Goblins, which was the first game I played for the NES, and from there on, I knew life was a pain.
Or either that it was going to be very hard.
I'll be honest, when I was a kid, I was under the impression that games weren't meant to be beaten. First of all, because I also had that that background in Atari and semi-arcade games, you know, that they just keep going infinitely. So I thought the point is just play, not to actually get anywhere with it. And with Ghosts and Goblins, that really enforces that because, it again, I finally beat that game last year. So it took me about 35 years to actually get around beating that game.
Hey, no shame in that. I didn't beat it for the first time until like 2017 or something like that. It was a game that I actively avoided because I'm like, this is just too hard. Like, why would I ever want to play this? But that's kind of the point, you know, to overcome the challenge, you know?
Yeah. Now, and you know, actually going through these really hard games, I kind of, it's funny because now when I'm more mature, I have better pattern recognition and I kind of understand better how the game was designed. And that actually helps me get much farther, because when I was a kid, I played 100% on reflex. So I was just reacting to whatever was happening on the screen at the time. Now, for example, boss patterns, I know after this attack comes this attack, and this is how I got to react and that kind of thing. So I generally think I'm in my prime when it comes to retro gaming. They say, you know, with age, your reflex slow down and all that kind of stuff. I think the medium is too young to actually make any kind of assessment like that, but I definitely do have a better understanding of how games work and how to overcome them. Game is complete BS, because sometimes it is.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's... I get that. Like, you see the ones and zeros. You kind of become one with the Matrix, and you're like, okay, I see what this game is trying to teach me. I see what it's trying to do. And sometimes, like you said, if you can't recognize the programming, then you know, like, oh, this is a fucking awful game. Like, this was just a bad game.
Yeah,
this is going to be a struggle.
Yeah, I call them out on stream all the time when I'm like, when I say, like, this is just complete BS. Like, by the way, what's your age rating on this podcast?
Listen, there is no rating. There's no age. Like, you can say whatever the fuck you want.
Okay, so, yeah.
I'm already talking about hard dicks at the top of the show, dude. Like,
oh, okay, yeah. So, it's bullshit. Like, the thing is, like, it's so hard because on stream, I try to keep it PG, which is 100% against my nature because I cuss like a wounded, like, pirate most of the time. So I try to keep it, you know, more family friendly. You know, I have a younger nephew, sometimes kids pop into my stream, that kind of thing. I don't want to be out there, like, you know, being that guy. I try to keep it family friendly, but it's hard. I dropped an F-bomb in Revenge of Shinobi, like, hard, and I was like, oh, well, excuse my French.
You know, having two kids, like, I really keep it under wraps, but, like, once the microphone is on, I just let it rip, like.
All right, cool. The point is, some games are bullshit. Bullshit. There you go.
Right.
All right, that feels liberating, actually, being able to say that to a mic.
And, of course, the last question is, what is your favorite game of all time?
So, my favorite game of all time, it's funny because it's not actually a retro game. Well, actually, if you go to the Retro Olympics, it is a retro game because there was a Bloodborne question there. But yeah, my favorite game of all time is actually Bloodborne. And there's many reasons for that, because if you're not really into Dark Souls and Souls games, it just looks like another Soul game. But that game, the gothic setting, the Victorian era, like, style, it's very gothic. It has beasts, you know, it's got body horror, it's got eldritch horror. There's just so much packed into that game that you don't really see on the surface. But once you beat it and go back and revisit the lore and that kind of thing, there is just so much going on. Also, that game really scratched my Castlevania itch. Last generation, because before that, what was their last good Castlevania game? Probably the DS ones, maybe. So pretty much it was, you know, there's tributes to Bram Stoker's Dracula there. There's that, you know, it's kind of hard to describe, but it just spoke to me on a very personal level. It ticked pretty much every box of what I like in a game. And I understand why some people are like, I hate Dark Souls, I hate Bloodborne. That's 100% valid. But in my specific case, that game just kind of, it just clicked with me.
Well, don't listen to my episode on Bloodborne. Or maybe do.
No, the thing is, like, I am a firm believer that not every game is for everybody. Some people tell me, I hate Bloodborne, is crap. And, you know, that's fine. It's your opinion. And I respect it. It's wrong, but I respect it.
You know, I mean, we talked about Bloodborne in the Discord and how, you know, I said I desperately was, like, really trying to get into it. And it just, all of the things you talked about, those are things that I really like aesthetically in a game like that. But I just could not, like, it was not sticking into me. I was just like, this is boring. I was just bored.
And I know the feeling, because I was that way with Hollow Knight. Hollow Knight is a Metroidvania. Everything about that game, it had, you know, they describe it as Souls-like combat in terms of, like, the enemies are hard. They have, like, recognizable patterns and all that. And I think I tried to beat that game twice, and every time I sink in, like, 40 hours into that game. So I gave it one hell of a college try, and still I ended up dropping it.
Yeah, see, I beat the shit out of it. But, like, when I think about revisiting it, I don't think it's one of those games I'm going to replay, like, anytime soon. So I don't know what that says about Hollow Knight, really.
I think there's such thing as a game being too long. Holy crap. I felt like Hollow Knight, every time I was like, okay, I think I'm making progress and I find a brand new area, and then you don't have a map, you're like, oh my God.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think my last...
It overstays its welcome.
Yeah. So I think that's it. If it was more bite-sized, because like something like Castlevania Symphony of the Night, I can beat that in 5 hours, you know? So I think it just dragged on too much for my taste. But I see it's valid in a lot of aspects, but it just, not for me. In paper, it should be, but it just, it didn't click. I don't know. It just didn't work for me.
Well, speaking of measurement of time and perhaps boring gameplay, let's get into today's game, which is Clock Tower. So, as always, I like to begin the breakdown of the game with our personal histories, and as is the theme for this month, for the Ghoulcade, it's going to be the same all around. I have no personal history with Clock Tower. I think Ryan from List Off, and I had him on last year when we just had a open discussion about survival horror and the horror genre and gaming, when we did that episode last year. We might have briefly talked about it and kind of like cited it as being like an influence to the modern genre that is horror games, but I think that's kind of it. But the reason why I chose Clock Tower this month is that I just kind of have this weird fascination with games that weren't released outside of Japan. Yeah, I talked about it in the intro before the intro, but this is only the second, well, I was going to say Famicom, it's a Super Famicom, but this is the only Japanese exclusive game that I've talked about on the show besides for Sweet Home. So these are the only two.
And it's funny, both of them are exactly pretty much on the same niche. You know, both of them are like survival horror, and we'll get into that like farther along. But I completely understand why they did not release this game on the West. But ironically, after you told me, hey, we're going to do an episode on Clock Tower, not much later, it got announced that it's getting an official Western release.
I willed it into existence.
Nice. Can you wield like something like Perfect Weapon 2 or something?
limited run, if you're listening to this, like you listen to me talk about Clock Tower or putting it on the schedule. I know my my Uncle Jeremy Parrish might be listening to this. I think he still works for Limited Run. But yeah, let's get that Perfect Weapon remaster.
Electric Boogaloo.
The giant bundles that they put together for that game.
It's kind of funny because with Perfect Weapon, I know you put that for Super Garbage Day. And I wanted to kind of like tag team on that. So I put in The Crow City of Angels, which is made by the same people. And it's the exact same type of game.
You know, something tells me that even though I put it on there to make them suffer, they're probably still going to enjoy it at some, like, there's something so broken and dumb about that game that it seems like it might be more enjoyable than it comes off as. So Clock Tower, but I mean, other than that, like, you really don't have any personal history with this game, right? I assume you don't.
Not really.
Unless you grew up in Japan.
Nah, I did run into this ROM years ago, like, and I did kind of like tried to play the intro, but never really actually took the time to play it. So I kind of move around the first screen and that's it. So pretty much I'm the same as you. I had no previous history with this game. With that series, for that matter, I haven't actually played any of the Clock Tower games, not even the ones that came to the West.
And it's interesting that you brought up the fact that they never released it here for... there's probably multiple reasons, right? But the one that I'm mostly thinking about is just, I mean, this is 1995. Nintendo was still kind of trying to compete with Sega and also have kind of the squeaky clean image as well. And this game is not that. It's very much a horror game.
Yeah, and if it's 95, that's around the time the PlayStation 1 was in the horizon already, so...
Right. But yeah, like, the development history for Clock Tower, so... It is a point-and-click adventure, and it was developed and published by Human Entertainment. I don't have a ton about the development here, just, you know, I figure we can kind of go into the legacy a little bit. Clock Tower was made by, like, a smaller team in the development team of Human Entertainment, and it was led by someone named Hifumi Kono, and it was kind of like a passion project, kind of like the way Mega Man 2 was, or Link's Awakening, or something like that. It's kind of something that, while they were doing their bigger games, because they did release a ton of fucking games, like, their history is very expansive. Like, they had, like, arcade games, they had stuff on the NES, the PC Engine, the Game Boy. They're most notable, I guess, for the Fire Pro Wrestling games. Whereas Clock Tower was just kind of like this thing they were off working in the corner. And
I have so many issues with so many terms you used. Point and click adventure. So having adventure there is kind of a stretch. And Human Entertainment, that were not two things that I actually saw while playing this game either. So yeah, there was clicking though. That part you did get right.
Yeah, but the one thing of note is that Kono was heavily inspired by Dario Argento films, and the biggest one being Phenomena, which is basically, from what I've read, is almost one in the same. Like, they kind of mirror each other. Are you familiar with Dario Argento or any of the films he's made? I think the other big one he's done is Suspiria.
Yeah, so I am familiar with Argento and vaguely with his work. It's not one of those I have actually sat and watched his films. So I just know, like, tidbits of everyone, but you can clearly see that this person was, the director was going for, it's basically an interactive horror movie. That's what they were going for. And I feel like it was kind of a mix of that with you remember those choose your own adventure books that, you know, you do this and this type of thing happens. That's how I felt the game kind of went.
No, when I think back to my experiences with the first Resident Evil game, and, you know, those FMV games for, like, the Sega CD, and there's some FMV games that came out in arcades, like, those existed before, and those were, like, literally movies. You were literally playing a movie, although you had no real agency in playing them, right? Like, the decisions you were making were very rigid. It was either you're doing this or you're doing the other thing. And Resident Evil was, like, the first game that I played where I was like, oh, I am controlling a movie. And they make it very easy for you to kind of get into that just because it is basically kind of directed. It has pre-rendered camera angles. The scenes are already set up. And when I was playing this, and this came out 6 or 7 months before Resident Evil, and I'm like, oh, this is, like, if I had played this in 1995, I may have not been as impressed with Resident Evil.
The thing is, out of the gate, so this game, the gameplay is, it's asinine, you know, but overall, a lot of the tropes you see in survival horror are already in this game. The walking around, you click on stuff and you see the character's thoughts on screen, you know. That type of stuff is exactly what Resident Evil was doing. They just did it better, like, overall with the pacing of the game. But it is clearly, you know, collecting items, finding out where to use them, the commentary on screen when you click on something. Basically, all those elements are Resident Evil, just with combat sprinkled in there. So it was actually onto something.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in the intro that I did give this game credit for having quite the legacy because, I mean, yeah, Resident Evil ushered in the genre of survival horror, right? But there were ideas, obviously, also from Alone in the Dark as well, and then you've got Sweet Home. Sweet Home and Alone in the Dark were doing two different things. They brought new mechanics to the genre, but didn't quite nail them down. Like, they were good at doing the things that they were good at doing. Clock Tower is very much the same. It's introducing new things, and it's good at doing those new things. But then Resident Evil came along and took, just grouped all that stuff together, introduced a little bit of combat, and now you've got a completely new genre.
Yeah, the thing is, like, Resident Evil got so much right the first time. I you know, cheesy dialogue aside, I still play that game, and I'm amazed of how you basically created a genre on your first try. You got every single trope right, and everyone from there tried to emulate you. It's still amazing how that game just kind of came together.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to emphasize, we're specifically speaking to mechanics that work within a horror genre. Obviously, point-and-click adventures are not a new thing in 1995. Those were mainly stuck on PC. You didn't get a lot of console point-and-clicks. I know I covered Shadowgate, which is an early NES game. I covered that on the show before.
Maniac Mansion.
Yeah. So there's certainly point-and-click console games, but they were not as prevalent as they were on the PC. So there's that. But
yeah, a lot of it has to do because the control does not work for point-and-click. Holy crap. That was just rigid, too. So you're just kind of like moving on grids, like square, just looking. And this game has no indication whatsoever. Well, it does have like a little square when something is clickable. But overall, you just have to kind of like you go on a screen pretty much through the whole grid, just finding what is actually interactable. It's painful.
Yeah, the point and click stuff in this game, as we'll get into it, it's not great. But the other things that it did, again, that it did do good, I believe it should be lauded for those attempts. But just to wrap this this portion up, Clock Tower was released on September 14th, 1995, which, at the time of this recording, we're literally coming up on the 28th anniversary of this game. And it was released in Japan for the Super Famicom. It was, now I might have some of this information backwards, or maybe I got something confused here. So I could be wrong about this information. But I believe it was remade for the PlayStation in 1997. And they added a few quality of life mechanics, new maps.
Yes.
New weapons.
Yes, there is a PlayStation port of this game. Also Japan only. And they did switch around the graphics and that kind of stuff. It didn't improve too much. It's not like they overhauled the whole gameplay, but it was more of an enhanced port.
Okay.
But yeah, there was a Japan only PS1 version.
Okay. Yeah, I was like, I'm not certain about this information, but I figured one of us would know, so.
But yeah, you are correct, sir.
And then it was ported to the PC, the Wonder Swan, of all things. And then it eventually got a Wii and Wii U Virtual Console release in Japan.
The Wonder Swan, is that the black and white handheld? Like, the Wonder Swan?
Yes.
Oh my God. Okay.
Could you imagine how awful this game plays on the Wonder Swan?
Yeah, no, the thing is, because that was like, was it Shadowgate? You know, I do remember there were some old games that came out for the, I think it was for Apple computers, and they were black and white, but it was on PC, and they were very detailed when it came to shadows and that kind of thing. I don't see this on a tiny Wonder Swan, like monitor just working at all.
This game would have worked great as a DS port or something.
Yeah, because you're
with the stylus. Because
you could point and click.
Yeah. It was followed up with two sequels: Clock Tower 2: The Struggle Within, and Clock Tower 3. And as you stated a couple minutes ago, it was announced that a remaster of the game, being produced by Way Forward and Limited Run Games, is coming out for the Switch, Xbox Series consoles, the PlayStation 4 and 5, and PC with a tentative 2024 release date. Review scores, for context, which aren't there aren't many. This is, again, a Japanese-only release that came out in 1995. There is a GameSpot review for... It got a 5.8 out of 10. Famitsu gave it 31 out of 40. And, again, because this is a very limited release, there's no goofy, strange user reviews that I could find. No common internet folk are talking about this game anywhere because nobody really played this. But every time I have a new game to talk about, I reach out on social media looking for your retro recollections. And I put the call out there. I'm playing Clock Tower. Have you played Clock Tower? What do you think of Clock Tower? And I expected nobody to reply. And I did get one on Instagram. We've got Pang. And all he has to add is, Scissor Man is the most OP.
That is deep. That is some very insightful commentary right there.
I mean, at least somebody knew what I was talking about, right?
Yeah, the thing is, like, some people might, you know, they hear Clock Tower, the PS1 version did come out during that survival horror boom of Resident Evil here in the West. So I think a lot of people might have actually had some exposure to the series through that. And Scissor Man is there on that one. So maybe that's about as far as it goes. But maybe he did play the original game and thought Scissor Man was amazing. But, you know.
I did specifically say the Super Famicom version. But I think it goes both ways either way. I was just surprised I had anybody at all say anything. So. So getting into the story and plot of this game, well, I'll start out by saying that I just want to mention how awesome the title screen is for this. Like, it sets the mood immediately as soon as you start it up. And the first thing I thought about was Chrono Trigger.
Definitely.
Because they're almost one and the same.
Yeah.
Kind of start with it. Different moods, though. Completely different moods.
Yeah, it's a little more ominous, but for a second I started out and then I thought, like, wait, did I run the wrong ROM?
You just start hearing, like, the little jingle or whatever, and all of a sudden, like, the crescendo and the music starts playing. You're like, is this Chrono Trigger? No, but yeah, Chrono Trigger's got, like, this hopeful and, like, inspirational theme, and Clock Tower's got, like, this dread and disdain. Like, it's completely different, but it's really good. I think it's awesome.
Is it time to talk about how the main theme is totally the Halloween theme?
I mean,
too early.
This is very, very John Carpenter. Yes. We'll get into that later.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, the theme fits perfectly too. I mean, the entire title screen. I mean, it sets the mood, man. I think it's great.
Yeah. No, I gotta admit, you put it on and then you out of the gate, you know, you're in for a suspense horror like experience. They got that right.
As for the story, so in a nutshell, I don't know how much we can spoil because this game is going to be re-released only a couple months after this comes out. I don't know how many people are actually going to pick it up and play it. Who knows? You, my friend, are the one that finished it. I did not, so I don't know what any of these endings are. I don't know how the game ends. And maybe we'll get into why I didn't finish it a little bit later. But
so I think we can go into the setting, and I'll try to avoid the spoilers in case anyone actually wants to play through the experience. If it's a very enhanced experience, I say go for it. If not, then it kind of buyer beware type of thing, because I'm intrigued to see how much they enhance the gameplay. Because honestly,
same.
This game, if it was paced right, And you know what you're doing? I think you could beat this whole thing in about 45 minutes. For the story, you want to give the story or you want me to kind of run through it?
I mean, I could just give the basic premise and setup. It's pretty simple. So the game focuses on an orphan named Jennifer and her friends, question mark, or are those her soon-to-be brothers and sisters?
So from my understanding, they all came from the same orphanage. They got adopted in a group, and Jennifer is totally Jennifer Connelly. Or is it just me?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, that's taken from the movie that this game is based off of, basically. Phenomenon.
Oh, okay.
So Jennifer Connelly was in that movie.
Okay, so yeah, I wasn't actually just like imagining it. The things, yeah. I hadn't watched the movie, I'm like, Jennifer, and I saw the portrait, I'm like, okay, so this is Jennifer Connelly. Okay.
Yeah, it's beat for beat, like the same aesthetics.
Okay.
So these orphans are taken to the Burroughs mansion by someone named Mary Burroughs. And once inside, Mary leaves to go find Mr. Burroughs. When the lights get cut out, and once they come back on, your friends are missing, and so is Mary. So at this point, it's our job to go find our friends and find our way out of the mansion.
And you know what's interesting about that? If you think about the intro of Resident Evil, you start in the main hall of a big mansion. You hear something in another room. You go to that room, and when you come back, everyone is gone. So the games literally like start almost exactly the same way.
Well, I mean, Resident Evil is just a remake of Sweet Home. I mean, Sweet Home starts the exact same way too, so.
Well, now I think about it, this is about as cliche as a horror setting as you can get.
I mean, yeah, really. I mean, honestly, yeah, at this point. I mean, how many horror games were there where people are just stuck in a house? It was the same way for Alone in the Dark, right? So. Basically, the thing that is chasing you this entire game is, we already alluded to him, the Scissor Man, or the Scissor Boy.
I thought it was Angus Young. It totally looks like Angus Young from AC/DC is chasing you around with a pair of scissors.
I feel like coming up for the promotion of this episode, I need to Photoshop Angus Young with a pair of giant hedge clippers.
Yeah, I mean,
doing like his dance or whatever.
Yeah, he even walks the same way. You see, you know, Angus, when he does the little strut with like the guitar, that this guy's kind of like limping around that way too. I couldn't shake that image out of my head.
But yeah, it's like we find out later, and I don't know if this is something you found out, but I read about this, is that the Scissor Man is like your brother or something.
Yeah, they do explain it. So let's just say spoiler alert.
Yeah, if you don't want to be spoiled, if you plan on picking up the remaster, just fast forward at this point until you hear the music cue, and we'll see you on the other side for the gameplay.
Yeah, so basically, Mrs. Voorhees over there, she adopted a couple of girls from an orphanage. You do actually, the girl you're playing as, Jennifer. Obviously, she's an orphan and she lost her father. While you're running around the house, next to the, I think it was next to the one of the, like, Angus's room, you find a secret jail, and you find a corpse, and then you can read a note. Turns out that corpse is Jennifer's father. She was the doctor that attended the birth of Angus and his twin. So that lady who adopted them, she actually had like two freak children, and he wrote about them, describing them as demons, and they actually ate his hand right when they came off the wound, and he died there in a cell. So this lady basically, like, her children killed her dad. They kept them there until he died, and then she adopted her from the orphanage.
Okay. I did get to that part in the game where you get into the hidden jail cell and you find all the notes and stuff like that. I just didn't understand the context for who these kids were. Oh, that's supposed to be her dad. A lot of that kind of was just kind of flew over my head.
Yeah, so I don't know how it all connects, because the way the setting looks, it looks like they took them to a very isolated place where the house is. But then turns out like her dad is there, so the orphanage couldn't have been that far off. So I'm not 100% sure how they all connect there. But long story short, Jennifer thought her dad died a long time ago. He actually died there in that cell. And then the lady adopted her among the other girls from the orphanage. The thing is, a lot of the story, it makes sense with stuff you actually find in the other games, and there's backstory that actually connects the dot. Because, for example, I don't even know what those girls got adopted to begin with. I don't know. I played the whole thing, and this is not explicitly like explained either.
Because you brought up a good point of like, oh, the orphanage must not be that far from the mansion. How did she not know her father was there, or a scientist, or working at this place? Like, so was he captured like before she was born?
Again, I'm not 100% sure how this all connects. This game has so many plot holes. Because Jennifer looks like she's what, probably like 16, 14 tops?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
So Angus is probably, he's like a child, but he's pretty big. So I will say he's about maybe 8, 10 years old.
He looks like a hefty boy.
Right. So her father must have been missing, you know, maybe she was a little girl when he went missing and she thought he was dead and they took her to the orphanage, but it's not really explained. Don't think about it. It just happens. Her dad's there. Cool stuff.
I mean, if anything, I appreciate the attempt at fleshing out the story. My only problem is, and it kind of goes into the gameplay, so I guess we can kind of start talking about that now, is that just everything is so randomized and it's so frustrating roaming around the mansion that by the time I got any story, and maybe this is why some of that stuff went over my head, because I was so fucking frustrated just finding my way around that by the time I got anything, I felt like, oh, I can just finally relax. I don't really care about any of this right now because I still have more of this game to play.
Yeah, let me preface by saying I have not played another game that is so blatantly disrespectful of your time as this one. Everything, every single thing in this game is a chore. Like the screen you start in, basically the foyer of the mansion, you go up the steps. If you click, it takes almost a whole minute real time just to see her walk from one side, get in front of the steps, go all the way up. Then on the upper floor, the only thing that happens is the floor breaks. There's nothing there. So now you have to spend another minute of your life just going down the stairs. I was actually, since I was playing on an emulator, since it was a fan like translation, if you hit the space bar, it actually speeds up. I use that a lot just to get around. The other thing is, basically, in this game, you don't really have health. You have kind of like a sanity meter that if you use up stamina, if you run everywhere, she walks really slow. If you run, you actually start panicking. So when you panic, you're actually more prone to die if you get attacked by Scissorman. So you can't really be in red for too long. And the way you actually heal is by standing still and just waiting it out. She will sit down on the floor and her stamina will start going up. And speeding this up to double speed, going from red to blue, it must have taken like 45 seconds. So it, like, to go to full health, you probably have to sit there for two whole real-time minutes just to go back to being a max health. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons why I didn't finish the game, is because I just did not have the time to sit there and actually walk around this game or do anything. All the time, like, all the times where I sat there and waited for her to gain her stamina or gain her health back, which also keep in mind doesn't work everywhere. It only works in certain parts of the mansion. It doesn't work everywhere. I would just get up from the couch and just go do something around the house.
Yeah, and the worst part is there are some time sensitive events in this game. Like when you start the game very early, you hear like a scream. And I actually never found a room where I had to go. I knew I had to go to like a pool. But the thing is, if you take too long getting to where the scream was, it will determine if a character dies or not. So this game is really slow. It forces you to stop like regularly. Then it has time sensitive events. It's just like rigged in a way to just kind of, unless you know exactly what you're doing, and it's very confusing. And some rooms are static, others are randomized in each playthrough. So it's not like you can go, oh, okay, in this playthrough, I'm just going to go from this room to this room, because you don't know where anything is going to be. It's very frustrating. Just walking around, if you run, you basically run your stamina out really quick. I get what they were trying to do, but the execution was very poor.
Yeah, and again, like this is just to set up the basics here. Like everybody, if you are into point and clicks, this is very much a point and click. I mean, I talked about Shadowgate. I talked about Disco Elysium. You point and you click on things and things happen. There aren't any like weird secondary mechanics or like late cursory gameplay changes or anything like late in the game. You point and you click and your character does stuff. But because this is on the Super Famicom or the Super Nintendo, when you click on stuff, it also causes the character to move, which sucks. It sucks because when you want to interact with the environment, Jennifer's either going to move or she has to move across the room to go see what you want to go look at, which is a huge pain in the ass when you consider how slowly she walks too. So it just, the point and clicking does not work on a console like
also,
this.
Also, it's very inconsistent. Sometimes you will click on something, she will walk her slow ass all the way there just to comment on it. Some other stuff, you click on it and she comments on it from across the room. So it's like, how can you make these observations, like some of them from anywhere and some you have to wait for her to walk 30 seconds in real time just to go like, this is a fireplace. I'm like, okay, thank you.
And you can make her run. You can use the L and R buttons to make her run. But again, it's draining your stamina. And it's just like, was there any other way they could have possibly tried to figure out how to map these buttons to make the actual main mechanic here, pointing and clicking, actually decent? And I don't know if there's an answer to that.
Yeah, because you actually, the proper way to move is pointing and clicking. And if you use the L and R button, it's kind of like a panic thing. You just run automatically. So you either click constantly and move the cursor at the same time, trying to find out what you're supposed to be clicking on. Or the easier way is just to keep running while you're moving the cursor and see what you can interact with. But then you're draining your stamina constantly.
And even then, like you were talking about the pixel hunting and how the cursor, when you can interact with objects, turns into a square. But like the cursor is so finicky that like you don't know what exactly when the cursor is actually going to turn into a square. It's very hard to find where you actually need to put the cursor to interact with anything.
Yeah, sometimes. And then the cursor also has kind of like a semi-lock-on when it's on something interactable. And then I found out later that there's some things that are interactable that are almost on top of each other. There was like a key I couldn't find in the whole game and I couldn't make any progress. And it was right under a doll that I had interacted with before. But basically, it was almost at the same spot what you interact with. So I didn't see it when I move around because it will lock onto the doll every time. So I just have to fish for that specific spot to use it. So even when you're just moving the cursor around, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to find what you need to interact with.
I'm not a huge fan of point and clicks. not to say that I haven't tried. I have a soft spot for Shadowgate, and I think the remake on the Switch is actually really good. But I, more often than not, all of the point-and-click console games that I have played have not been great. I mean, even Disco Elysium was problematic in that regard. So, yeah, this is very rough. I mean, it's 1995. I guess it's to be expected, but it's rough. I do want to go back to what we were talking about with Jennifer's stamina, and then also kind of start talking about the mechanics of the Scissor Man. In that, if you do run into Scissor Man and you are low on stamina, it's pretty much game over. Like, you can't, there's no way you're dealing with him. And I really, really fucking appreciate the way the game handles death, because it's not really a punishment, because there's basically an autosave, which is fucking great, because it's like, oh, you just died and you can start, or basically right outside the last door you walked through, which also presents different scenarios to you, because everything is essentially randomized. Even most of the encounters with Scissor Man are also randomized at points, which goes back to, I guess, something else I was going to mention, in that I accidentally restarted the game because at the title screen, they have like what do they call it? It's like quick start.
Oh, yeah. So the quick start is so you don't have to go through the beginning cutscene and go straight to the game. So you probably thought it was a quick load.
Exactly, yeah. So the first time I died to Scissor Man, I was like, oh, well, let me see what this quick start is. And it basically reset the game. So I was just like,
ouch.
Oh, I just goofed. I just completely fucked up that. So
yeah, you know, the funny thing is, like, now that you mentioned the panic encounters with Scissor Man, this game, it's basically what became popular with games like Amnesia. This game was already doing at that time, where you run into an enemy and there is no fighting, but you have to pretty much run to a place to hide, waiting for the encounter to actually go away, which is, it was kind of cool at first, but it really gets in the way of the exploration, because you might be in a room, you click on something, and then, you know, Scissor Man pops, and then you just have to run. You can't really interact with anything, and you are automatically running while you're panicked and he's chasing you. His chasing theme is actually great, though. It does a great job of, like, putting you in tension.
It's great.
It's like that. It's kind of hard to describe. It sounds like an electric guitar shredding, like, in a with weird distortion.
It's Angus Young, dude. Of course it is.
Oh, yeah. There you go. But also, it will happen to me that I am methodically exploring room to room. Then he's chasing me. I ran so far away from where I originally was that when I've actually found a hiding place, I have no idea where I am anymore. And this mansion kind of looks the same. Like, it's color-coded where you are, but first and second floor basically look the same. And every time there was an encounter, it was just like pain just getting back to where I was. I have to yeah, go ahead.
Just to what you were saying about the layout of the mansion, also having the rooms completely randomized doesn't help this either. There's no fucking map. So I did eventually pull up a guide because I was like, I gotta finish this. Like, this walking animation is taking too long. I've got to cram this at this point for the episode. I need to finish this. And I opened up a guide, desperately trying to find exactly where I was, which I could not figure out. I did not want to start the game over. And then, like, they give me this map, and it's like, if room A is in room B's position, that means that you have to go to room D through room E. But if room E is not room D, then you go to room B. And I'm like, dude, no. Absolutely fucking, like, you can't even get your map straight. Like,
yeah, no, I actually had to look up a map at some point, because, like, I don't know how big this mansion is, and I thought I was going around in circles, and it really took me a while. I had to walk all the way to the beginning of the game so I can pinpoint, okay, this is the starting point, this is where I am on the map. And once you understand it, the layout is not so complicated. There's two floors and there's a foreground and a background. That's it. But which rooms lead to the background? They're like long corridors and most of them are blocked off. So it's very hard to wrap your head on have a 3D image of how the mansion actually looks in your head. It took me a while to actually get my bearings, and it's not intuitive. It really isn't.
Throughout the game, while I was playing the game, I was having some fun with it. Like, I'm not gonna lie, there was points where I was walking around, and it is very good at building tension. It's very good at building atmosphere. The Scissor Man is part of that. He is very much kind of like a prototype of Mr. X or the Nemesis, because he can seemingly pop out of nowhere. I mean, there was one instance where I was just walking down a hall, and all of a sudden he just showed up in the hallway, and I'm like, oh, fuck. And then there are parts where I did kind of legitimately, like, I wasn't scared, but I jumped. I legitimately was like, oh, shit. Like, I'd, like, book it the other way, you know, down the hallway.
No, and I gotta say, the sound design is great in this game. The actual, like, snipping of the scissors and the use of stereo, you know which direction he's coming from, and you kind of hear it in the distance getting closer and closer. So that's actually very freaky. And the thing is, this game, it can be on the same room. Like, I didn't play the game before, but I do remember distinctly seeing a Scissor Man encounter on a piano. That is something that I do remember seeing at some point in my life. And I'm like, okay, there's the piano. I'm not going to interact with it because I know that's going to trigger Scissor Man. So I'm going to see what's behind these drapes. And he popped out of the drapes. And I'm like, oh, crap. Like, I deliberately tried to avoid the encounter and he popped out somewhere else. So I was, okay, so even if you do know what the game has in store for you, there are, he might actually pop out of somewhere else. But with that said, I interacted with a box in a room. The box started moving. I'm like, holy crap. And a literal springboard cat came out.
Oh, so yeah, that happened to me too. I think that's right before you break into that jail cell.
Here's a problem. That happened to me three times in different rooms. I'm like, okay, so what's this, like, drawer here? And then, you know, it starts, like, doing, and then another springboard cat. I'm like, okay, there's clearly a randomized, like, element to it. But springboard cat is a mechanic you use once. You can't just keep using that over and over. That is the one of the most goofed on, like, horror movie tropes there are, but the fact that it got randomized and it kept happening, I'm like, come on, man.
Yeah, the instance I didn't run into it that often, but I died at the Scissor Man. He popped out of a box and I died. And then the next, I respawned, I guess is the word. I went back in that room and yeah, the cat jumped out instead of Scissor Man. And that's like the first time I noted where I was like, oh, this is all randomized. Like, no one playthrough is exactly going to be the same.
Yeah, on paper, it sounds like this is going to give the game replay value. But in a game as tedious as this one, that just adds to the tedium that, okay, I beat the game. I know exactly what I have to do this time. I'm just going to just go for another ending, and then everything's randomized. So it throws a wrench in the whole thing if you just want to enjoy the story the second time around.
Well, let's roll right into this episode's game, which is a game that I would like to call Sincerest Form of Parody. Now, we learned earlier tonight that this game was heavily inspired by Dario Argento's film Phenomena, and there are many games that are inspired from movies that came before them. And so basically, I am going to give you the name of 10 movies, and you have to guess either the game or the franchise that those movies inspired.
Okay.
Are you ready to start?
As ready as I'll ever be. Go for it.
All right. The first movie here is Alien.
So what game was inspired by Alien? I will have to go mostly with Metroid. Metroid has a female protagonist. Samus, you know, it's very biomechanoid. Ripley is basically Ridley's name is based on that. So I am going with Metroid.
100%. Yes. All right. So far, so good.
Yeah, 100%, baby. I'm going to quit while I'm ahead. I'm the champion.
Event Horizon.
Oh, Event Horizon 102,000% inspired Dead Space. There's just, you know, you have the setting, the abandoned ship, the plot with the wife, all that. It's blatant.
Did I give you my document on accident? Yeah, that's right.
No, my mind is just a giant database of useless facts that are not useful, but, you know.
Perfect for the show. Perfect. Yeah, that's right. Moving on to number three here. Escape from New York.
Escape from New York. So you got a guy with an eye patch called Snake and a mullet. So I'm going to say it inspired Call of Duty. No, that it's what? Yeah, so Snake Plissken and Metal Gear Solid 2. Snake calls himself Iroquois Plissken. It's Metal Gear Solid.
I was like, do I even need to play the sound? Yeah, 100%. Mad Max.
Mad Max. Wow. Mad Max has inspired so much stuff that actually narrowed it down to a specific one you're talking about. But I think one of the main ones it inspired, especially because of the dog, the leather armor with the leather jacket with the shoulder pad. I will think that Fallout will be the most inspired by Mad Max.
Yes. God damn, dude. Okay, well, maybe this one will slip you up. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Try me.
I'm just not used to. Listen, man, the recent rash of episodes that I've had, people are just like, I don't fucking know. So I'm not used to this.
I was there, Gandalf, 3,000 years ago.
Yeah. You fucking listen to those Retro Olympics episodes. You're like, I'm fucking ready. Movie 5. The Blair Witch Project.
Blair Witch Project. So Blair Witch, the whole thing, it was the found footage type of thing, you know, through a camera. What is this called? Outlast? Outcast? That's what I'm thinking. Well, it's a horror game. You use a camera. You can see through a night vision type of thing. I don't know if that's the game you had in mind, but I think that was heavily inspired by Blair Witch.
That was not the one I was looking for very specifically. It is Slender : The Arrival.
Okay.
Which is like you're roaming around the woods, going into like around like woods and parks and stuff like that, and avoiding Slender Man, which is cannot be said around these parts where I live.
Okay, yeah.
So I have to be very careful.
Yeah, I lean more into the found footage camera type of thing, but yeah, I can totally see it.
Be interesting to see where you go with this one. Again, no trick questions on my show.
Yeah, but to my defense, I do have some rationale against my questions with my answers. There is some to it. I'm not just like firing blanks here.
Oh,
but
sure.
Yeah, go for it.
I know. I do believe Slender came out before Outlast, so I think that's why I credited the Blair Witch Project more than that.
All right, cool.
But it'll be interesting to see where you go with Indiana Jones.
Wow. So no trick questions here.
No trick questions. Never. I would never trick any of my guests.
Because, like, there's so many aspects to Indiana Jones. You can have, you know, the whole pulp action of it, or you can go just to the fact that he has a whip. So, Indiana Jones.
I mean, there were explicit Indiana Jones references in the Fallout games, so.
Yeah. So, I'm going to my reptilian brain here, and I know it's not the most one-to-one example to Indiana Jones, but I do roughly remember hearing somewhere that they wanted to make Castlevania a series where the guy uses a whip and it was inspired by Indiana Jones. That's my best guess, but I'm not sure if that's what you're going for.
Is that your final answer?
Well, shit. Okay, so let me think about it.
Everything is on the line.
Yeah. The thing is, like, there was this Genesis game called Ernest Evans that had it was blatantly like Indiana Jones in the cover. He also had a whip. But wow. Okay. So I don't think you're talking about more modern games. So I'm going with Castlevania, final answer. Screw it.
The answer I was looking for was Tomb Raider.
Oh, come on. Okay.
If Harrison Ford had big tits.
Yeah, the thing is, I was kind of overthinking there. Like, that's what I do. I overthink like every aspect of the question, because he told me, like, yeah, Tomb Raider, Uncharted, they were like clearly inspired by, you know, but okay. You got me.
The next movie is actually Blade Runner.
Blade Runner. So, yeah, so a game that is blatantly Blade Runner to the point where I think that's almost like copyright infringement, I will have to go with Hideo Kojima's Snatcher.
Oh, actually, good answer.
Not what you were looking for.
Not what I was looking for. Deus Ex.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see it. But come on, man. It's like you play as Harrison Ford in Snatcher.
Yeah. I feel like I should give you like half a point for that one. Because even when you said that, I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I went with the most obvious one, but also Blade Runner is like the father of like cyberpunk, like, so right. There's so much inspired by it. But I thought you were going for the blatant ripoff. Okay. you got me.
I'll give you half a point on that one.
Yeah.
So moving on to the next one. Scarface,
you know, coke, drugs, guns, cars, Grand Theft Auto, man. It has to be, like, you gotta give me that one.
I can give you half a point.
No! Okay.
I'm looking for a specific GTA.
Oh, then Vice City, man. If you're looking for a specific one, okay.
Yeah, I mean, that is the entire story and the characters, everything. Yeah.
You did say in the rules that it was game or serious.
I mean, that's just that's just crime movies in general.
Okay, yeah, okay.
But
Vice City, I knew that one.
Yeah. Dawn of the Dead is the number 9 movie here.
Dawn of the Dead. So the obvious answer will be Resident Evil, but Dawn of the Dead is the one in the mall setting, right?
Yes.
So if I'm going by the mall setting, I will actually, specifically because of the mall setting, I will have to go with, Dead Rising?
Yes, another Capcom joint there. You know, it's going to be interesting where you go with this one. Again, no trick questions. Jacob's Ladder.
So That is actually my favorite horror movie. Fun fact. So the imagery, the blurry faces, the questioning of what's real or what's not. And I don't want to spoil the ending, but this game actually has a ending that is a clear reference to it. So I'm going to go with Silent Hill.
You nailed it, man.
Yeah. The thing is, funny thing, the first time I beat Silent Hill, my first reaction was, that is a reference to that movie because I did get the worst ending.
I don't even remember what ending I got. I haven't played that game since it came out, basically. Again, hey, I'm a fake survival horror fan, so.
Yeah, I mean, you haven't barely played one, haven't played two, man. What are you doing with your life, man?
I have no idea. Also, I guess I just never pay attention to it, but I have a Blade Runner poster up here. I don't know if you see the movie posters I've got along the wall, but
I don't see the Blade Runner one, but
no, it's off camera, but
I do see Akira. Akira, the Akira manga is my favorite work of fiction, actually.
It's one of my favorite movies. It's so fucking good.
And the funny thing is that came out in 88 and it's still animated better than 90% of what's out there.
100%. Like, it's so fucking crazy detailed. I was watching some behind the scenes thing, probably a couple weeks ago at this point, and just all of the work that they had to do. I'm like, this is slave labor, basically. Like, what part of this was fun for them?
Oh yeah, no, definitely. And that was during the economic bubble in Japan. There was so much budget to do that kind of stuff at the time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So you got 7.5 out of 10. Congratulations, dude.
Yeah, I gotta see.
I guess going into these, I really don't know how well anybody will do. And like I said, I kind of asked you off air, like, how deep is your movie knowledge? Because I wasn't sure how well the connections would be made. I did have a backup game, and I have a feeling that wouldn't have gone as well.
Yeah, the thing is, again, I've always been into movies and video games, especially 80s and 90s. So that's kind of like my thing. And I've always in my head tied games and movies whenever I see a reference, because I'm really good at picking that kind of stuff up. So yeah, I pretty much a lot of this, I was just kind of spitballing, connecting two and two. But yeah, I'm a total... I was a movie buff, movie geek, game geek and everything and that kind of stuff. So it got me a 7.5. So, I'll take it.
Well, that has been a sincerest form of parody. So basically we're going to close this episode out with the graphics and music, which, I mean, we kind of talked about here and there. I think the graphics in Clock Tower hold up incredibly well. The mansion is really well designed, and even though parts of it kind of look samey, I still never really felt safe in this game. As I said, like, Scissor Man can kind of just appear out of nowhere a lot of times.
Yeah, the presentation was actually pretty good. I did like that the artwork was, it almost looked like digitized graphics, you know? It gave it kind of like this uncanny valley type of vibe to it, which made it very ominous. It didn't feel cartoony at all. And that kind of... the graphics, the look of the game, the atmosphere, I think they nailed it. If this game has something going for it, it's the atmosphere.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the fact that the sprites look digitized. At least as far as I know, they're not. They're all hand-drawn sprites. Like, there's nothing digitized. They didn't get actors in a studio and, like, film them or anything like they did with Mortal Kombat or something like that.
Yeah, the thing is, like, I said they look kind of digitized. They went for a very realistic look for them, especially like in that beginning cutscene. It almost looked like they took a pictures and that just drew over them, but it was a very realistic art style, which stands out from the Super Famicom, Super Nintendo library.
Which I think is probably also why Jennifer moves so slow, because they painstakingly animated all of that.
Maybe there was some rotoscoping involved, and with the limitations of the Super Nintendo, I can see how that will be painstakingly hand-drawn and just very hard to pull off.
Just the other note I have here on the mansion is just the Victorian aesthetic that it has is really suits the game very well, really lends to that incredibly creepy atmosphere that it has. As problematic as I think the layout of the mansion is, I think it looks fucking fantastic. And the most interesting thing I want to touch on, I think, is just how well directed the game is. For something that is a 2D point and click, it's kind of a weird thing to say, but the game being like directed, but like, you know, we talked about the opening cutscene. You just talked about how good it looks. But like, there's a fair amount of text in this game. And so like, when characters are talking to each other, a lot of the scenes are like framed really well. The way the game frames like its rooms, and if you run into Scissor Man, or if you run into Mary eventually throughout the game, those interactions are framed really well, just because of just the way the game looks. Essentially, it just really lends to those scenes very well.
Yeah, it to me clearly had they were going kind of for an interactive movie type of vibe, and they probably thought point and click is the best way to achieve this, but that really takes away from the experience. So the ideas were really good. A lot of what you see here, again, you see it in Resident Evil, but they pulled it off better with the actual gameplay, how tight it is, the controls, the combat, that kind of thing. So the ideas, I do give this game a lot of credit in terms of the idea of what it was trying to be and the way they went about it. Because apart from the gameplay, I actually enjoyed the experience. Which, when you're talking about games, it's kind of a huge aspect of it. But overall, I did have a good time with this game just because I saw the whole thing through and appreciate what they were doing.
Yeah, and another thing, and slide into the music here, that adds to the atmosphere is the music. Or lack thereof. I think the way this game uses silence is incredibly meaningful to playing Clock Tower, because most of the time you're roaming around this mansion, all you're hearing is Jennifer's footsteps, which adds to the tension and just waiting for something to happen, or when you open up the door, someone to pop up and scare you or something. And you mentioned the theme song for Clock Tower, which again, it's Halloween. It reminds me of John Carpenter's Halloween, like straight up. It has like this spooky electronic synthesizer to it, and it's an earworm, you know? I mean, I can hear it in my head right now. It's very catchy.
And also, when you bring the footsteps and that kind of stuff, depending on what room you were, there was actually, for example, if you were in the bathroom, the footsteps have some reverb to them, so they were kind of echoey. So also depending on what room you were in was how the game sounded, and that was kind of unnerving, you know, the feeling of hearing carpet versus hearing the tiles and that kind of thing. And you also see that in Silent Hill, Resident Evil, all that. This game nailed it from the get-go.
Yeah, and I mean, those were on more powerful systems, for all intents and purposes, better sound chips and things like that. You know, for this to be a Super NES game, you know, that means something. Overall, I mean, this game isn't filled with, like, music in, like, you know, something like a platformer would have or something. Like, this is music with purpose, right? It's supposed to set a tone. It's supposed to set an atmosphere. And it does it really well. Even the stingers when Scissor Man shows up. When those violins hit or whatever they are, or the synthesizers hit, and then all of a sudden it goes, slides into his music, it's great. And again, like you said, it's gives the player a lot of anxiety as he chases you around and that music is playing.
Yeah, and again, we go to Resident Evil. You know, there was on Resident Evil Nemesis, there was like a pre-Nemesis music that just kind of felt that he was lurking around. A lot of times, this Scissorman music will start playing and he's nowhere on the screen, but you know he's somewhere. And then eventually you start hearing the scissor snipping, and it builds up that tension really well.
Everything here, like as far as presentation goes, graphics and music, I think this is some of the best stuff on the Super NES. It's one of the reasons why I think people remember this game as much as they do, the ones that have played it.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's a lot here. And I don't know, again, how much this inspired later survival horror games, but I do feel like a lot of them took a big page out of this game of what it did right and implemented it with better gameplay. And that's why those series are more, they have a bigger legacy than Clock Tower. But I think for this first effort, they tried something very bold, and for the most part, they pulled it off.
All we have to do at this point is summarize our discussion, give our final thoughts, and if we would recommend checking out Clock Tower in 2023. And I feel like we're both kind of on the same page with this game. I think I'll close out here first, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
So, you know, we talked about the game's legacy a lot, I feel like, and we talked a lot about the things that it does do good and some of the forward-thinking mechanics that it has. And for its time in 1995, when it came out, and when you consider that this was a console game and not a PC game, it's kind of revolutionary. I really do think it is. I appreciate this game for what it is, but I honestly would find it very hard to recommend to people, even if you do enjoy point-and-click games. I feel like this would not be something you would enjoy. Even if you like horror games, for that matter, I feel like this is going to be a hard game to get into. I keep bringing up Sweet Home in this episode. I do think it's warranted, because I feel the same way about Clock Tower as I do that game. It's a very cool game, just like I thought Sweet Home was. I think it's very interesting, like Sweet Home. And they do very, very cool things for the hardware that they're on, but they are horribly flawed. And like Sweet Home, every time I thought about playing Clock Tower, I got excited. I was like, yeah, I do want to play more of this game. But then I would play it for like 20 or 30 minutes, and I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. So, yeah, man, I mean, it's great at building tension. The graphics and music are really, really fucking good. I understand that Human Entertainment wanted you to feel like a helpless teenage girl. But when it comes down to it, like, I just felt like a frustrated teenage girl. Because, like, point-and-click adventures are just not made well for the Super NES. So, in a lot of ways, this game holds up, in my opinion. And I think it's incredibly interesting for the things that it does, but also at the same time is very frustrating for what it doesn't do. I'm just kind of like wasting time here. I feel like I'm going to give this like the lightest not recommend I can give it, because I really don't feel like I can go on to the other side and recommend this, because I don't think overall anybody would really have a fantastic time with this, other than it just being a weird curiosity like it was for me. So on to you.
So I echo a lot of your sentiment when it comes to this game, the presentation. You can tell there was passion put into this. I don't know. I kind of feel like maybe this project was too ambitious for the Super Famicom, because the slow gameplay, it kind of sort of feels like padding to me. Because as I said, if you go to directly to what you have to do in this game and you actually went straight for it, you could beat the whole game in about 45 minutes. It's not a long game at all, but those 45 minutes will turn to, in my case, it took me probably 5 to 6 hours to beat this game. And, you know, the point and click aspect of it is, you know, it's in terms of hit or miss, it's a miss. There was so much potential, but the tedium is just too much to put it up with, even if the atmosphere is great. The mystery, there is intrigue in this game, trying to figure out what the resolution is and that kind of stuff. So I will say, if you're curious, you're probably better off watching a playthrough on YouTube to go through the whole thing, watch someone else do it, maybe speed up through the boring parts. But I honestly can recommend someone playing this game because it's not fun. It really isn't. You're going to spend so much time literally doing nothing, for example, healing or waiting for Jennifer to walk from one side to the other, that you'll feel that it's just a big waste of time. And so I can't, in good conscience, recommend it. I really hope that they do add some huge quality of life improvements on the new version, possibly a map. Speed it up, maybe add smoother animation, that kind of thing. And then maybe it will be worth it. But as it currently stands, I can't recommend this. I would really love to because I liked a lot about this game. But it's just not fun. That's about as best as I can sum it up.
Funny enough, you said, you know, in your recommender, that lack thereof, that somebody could maybe just go look up a Let's Play or whatever. Perhaps they could watch somebody stream the game. So at this point, the floor is yours. Why don't you let everybody know where they can find what you do on the internet?
All right, well, I am Van Ferno, a self-described boomer gamer with a passion for retro games. Mostly, I play everything retro. To me, my definition of retro is 128 bits and back. Eventually, everything will be retro, but that's mostly what I stream in my channel. And I do like to have a focus on hardcore games because they're frustrating and people love to see me fail. So that actually is what is most popular. But you can find me on YouTube under Van Ferno's Retro Stream. That's Van Ferno, V-A-N-F-E-R. Look at the show notes. I don't even have to spell that. And you can also find me on Instagram under Retro Stream. That's retro.stream. I post previews of what my next games are going to be. And from there, you can instant message me if you would like to see a game. And that's the easiest way to just interact with me directly. But yeah, you get free to drop by the stream, have a laugh seeing me get frustrated with really hard games. And, you know, overall, we have a pretty tight-knit community. We have a bunch of regulars, and overall, it's a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, all those links are going to be in the show notes. I'm very bad at watching people stream. I'm not a person that pops into streams, and which sucks because, like, half the people I know stream. And I'm always like, yeah, I'll try and watch, but I'm really bad at it. But the times I have popped into your streams, they are very fun. The community that you have in there chatting with you, also very awesome people. Yeah, it's a good time. So I definitely recommend you guys go check it out whenever you're streaming, man. It's always a good time. And of course, thanks for joining me on the show tonight, man.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun. I did enjoy the game show at all, like a lot. I didn't know what to expect, but you actually got me to use my brain over here and things, so that was a lot of fun, and I appreciate you for inviting me.
Oh, yeah, anytime. So with that, the Ghoulcade rolls on with, funnily enough, one of the games that was probably heavily inspired by Clock Tower, by total mistake. I didn't even think about this until you actually mentioned it. We're going to be talking about Amnesia, The Dark Descent. So until then, I'll talk to you guys later. Wait, that's not my sign-off. I forgot how to sign off all of a sudden. Take care of yourselves. And always remember, it's okay to like a video game.
Keith is just a bummer. He said bad words on the Main Quest podcast.